Maine Calling Book Club is back with a discussion of Monica Wood's memoir, When We Were the Kennedys. When We Were the Kennedys takes us back to Mexico, Maine in 1963 and life in a mill town. Monica Wood's family lived and worked there. Her father came to Maine from Prince Edward Island to work at the paper mill. The Wood family story is much like many others in Maine, with one important exception. When Monica was in fourth grade, her father died of a heart attack. Monica's memoir is about her family, her town, and her life in the aftermath of his death. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and today on Maine Calling, I invite you to join our discussion about a book that's been called a marvel of storytelling. Share your recollection of life in a mill town, in a small town, and life in Maine in the early 1960s. It's the Maine Calling Book Club, but first, these news headlines. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The setting is 1963, Mexico, Maine. The protagonist, a 9-year-old girl, part of a large Catholic family whose father works at the mill. Her world, Monica Wood's world, is shattered when her father dies of a heart attack. Then the president, beloved by Monica's Catholic family, is killed. These are the defining events in a remarkable memoir by Monica Wood. When We Were the Kennedys is the subject of today's Maine Calling Book Club. And joining me to discuss the book, Mamie Ney. She's the head librarian for the Auburn Public Library. David Richards, director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library in Skowhegan. And Peter Kalman, a labor union leader and labor historian. We invite you to join our conversation. Have you read When We Were the Kennedys? If so, what did you think? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all three for being here and from different parts of the state. I love that. I love to have this perspective, and thank you all for being here in the Portland studio with me
today.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank you.
You know, making notes, I reread the book this morning, and I had read it first when it first came out, and I sort of started to analyze, and I said, well, you know, this book's really about a loss of innocence, not only for Monica by losing her father, but also for her town, with the labor strife at the mill, and then for our nation. But then even writing that, I thought to myself, it seems so stilted to analyze this emotional and personal book in that way. And I know that, David, you've been leading book discussions about this book. How do you come at those and talk about it and balance those, you know, all the sort of messages with just the fact that this book is such a wonderful personal story?
Well, as a historian, that was sort of my first approach, is, oh, what history can we take out of this book, particularly given the title? But once you start having a conversation with a group of people, so often when people are reading a book, they're connecting it to their own lives, and there's so much material here that people can draw from. So it did become a conversation much more on that personal level. And I think it's actually in the second discussion where we'll try to go back to some of the history that's in the book.
Okay. And Mamie, I know that you talked to Monica before you came on the program today. Tell me about that conversation.
Well, we were going to try and get together for a cup of coffee to have, you know, a good discussion about the book, just to get her perspective from writing it. So I asked her, I said, what would you want me to convey to people about the book? And she basically said, you know, in an email, she told me that she's been very gratified by the number of people that have written to her because they see it as their story. It is the personal outreach from the book that grabs you at first. And she said, you know, it didn't matter what generation they were from or what their upbringing was, they were able to identify with it. And she said that she thought that the theme of loss, the loss of a loved one, the loss of a way of life, the loss of a hometown, resonated with so many of her readers, that's what, you know, that's what she wanted to convey about the book.
Because we'll all experience loss.
Exactly.
If we haven't already. And Peter Kalman, you've also spoken with some people that you know who have been involved in the labor union movement and people who live in the Rumford, Mexico area.
Yeah, that's right. And for me, it was, I just love reading a book about, you know, that focuses on a working class family in a working class town. And it's even better that it's in Maine and even better that it's a paper mill town. Haven't spent a lot of time there. And I think it's a lot about, you know, Samuel Gompers was the first president of the American Federation of Labor. And he said, labor is who we are. capital is what we produce. And we live in a society that's kind of reversed that, tries to get us to believe that somehow the reverse exists. And in reading this book, it's about a family and what they go through, and they're the producers. You know, her father was a foreman in the mill. His life was the mill. The family was the mill. And, of course, that's true of the loss, too, and we're all going through that with jobs in this whole country. And one of the things I really loved about the book was she talks about when she was helping to make the shoes with her friend.
I remember that, the friend, yep.
And she says, you know, she talks about how it was to actually make something. And I think that is this huge statement when you look at NAFTA and all these things that have happened. So many of people are growing up today without ever having made anything.
And talking about the redeeming power of work, that her mother in some way didn't want her sewing shoes with her friends, but then also understood the redeeming power of this work.
Yeah. I mean, I worked in a shoe shop and many years ago, a couple of them. And to this day, when I go to buy shoes, you know, I look at it from like, wow, I wonder who made it, and I can see the stitching. You know, I identify with it. And this book was so much about the identification of people with work, which we don't hear that much about anymore.
Right, and maybe not redeeming, but healing power. I can't find the page right now as I'm looking at this. David, we want to come back to you as a historian. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that people who are coming to the Margaret Chase Smith Library this year are reading When We Were the Kennedys. Why is that?
Well, what we decided to do is this is the 50th anniversary of Margaret Chase Smith running for the Republican presidential nomination in 1964. So as part of the programming, I wanted to put together a book discussion group. And I thought about, you know, how to start. And I thought this would just be the perfect book to start because it would bring us from 2014 back 50 years ago. And really place us very centrally in central Maine. And, you know, with that first discussion, it was very clear to see that people very much did identify with it. And as I say, there is lots of history in here. She does make references to the Cold War, to the Kennedy assassination. She fast forwards us ahead into the early 1970s when she's going to Georgetown. And so we start to see how this youth movement has bubbled up. There's little bits of evidences of it with her brother Barry, who has this rockabilly band that he's a part of. And, you know, we hear about Elvis. And you can already see things that are starting to bubble in the early 1960s, which we know from the mid to late 1960s really do bubble up even more.
One thing that's interesting to me, Mamie, and just so wonderful is how it puts you there. This book puts you right there. You can imagine living in the apartment that Monica's family lived in. You can imagine her neighbors, her friends. But then little things that cultural shifts. One is when she talks about the shame of widowhood when her mother, and I thought to myself, that's not the case anymore. There are many things if you become a widow, but shame isn't one of them. And there are dozens of little comments like that that make you realize how our culture has
changed. That's true. And there was one section in the book where, you know, they're waiting for Anne to come home. And she talks about how things have already shifted. She says, before Anne came home, this is right after her father died, 30 stopped minutes, a grotesque ongoing now in which our mother shed her former self like a wind shook tree. And that just is such a shift for her. And it did have a shame. I remember when I was going to school, somebody's father died in first or second grade, and you always just whispered about it. Now there isn't, you're more apt to reach out and do things for people. So those are the shifts. But if you really think about it, I think what struck me most about this book is that, you know, when my father died, he was 84, and it was still a terrible event for me. So I can't imagine happening to me at a young age. But it does happen all the time. And it's how she took this story and made it come alive. And I think in reading all of the reviews from readers that I did, and I have to give a shout out to Monica because she responded to them, whether they were good or bad reviews. She said, I'm glad you read the book, or I'm sorry you didn't see it this way, which I thought was great because there were, you know, I read a couple hundred different reviews. And it's just how she can make not an ordinary story, but it is a daily, it is a part of daily life, how she could make that come alive. I think that speaks volumes for her writing and for her book.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to our Facebook page. There's so much in this book and so much in the lives, Monica Wood's family's life, but, and it touches not just on sort of living in a small town, living in a mill town, and living in a Catholic town, which I think are very big themes, but small things. Her sister is mental, you know, has a, you know, mentally disabled. She has, there are many ethnicities in the book. Her family, her father was from Prince Edward Island. Her best friend is Franco-American. The people who live downstairs are from Lithuania. Peter, do you think from the people you've met in these mill towns over the years, is her experience typical of any mill town in Maine?
Pretty much they're all the same. I mean, sometimes the ethnicity changes a little bit. The Lithuanians are mainly around Rumford, Mexico. You've got, you know, Italians and Jay. So the Italians come to Jay, for example, because when the first International Paper Company was built, they brought in 500 Italian contract laborers, lived in a tent city, essentially, and then they ended up staying, a lot of them, and working in the mill eventually. But one of the things I thought was atypical that she writes about is she mentions in a number of times about how they have to be really quiet going up the stairs. Now, her father only works one shift. He just works for a shift. But most of the production workers in those mill towns at that time worked 1 week first shift, 1 week second, or I'm sorry, 1 week third shift, 1 week second shift, which meant that in an apartment building of any size, at any time, somebody's going to be sleeping. So you got to be quiet. And in this book, it comes across more as, you know, it was kind of a strange thing that the Lithuanians did. You know, they weren't working in the mill. And the people that live on the other two floors aren't working in the mill at the time. But for most people living in those apartment buildings, their kids are going to have to be quiet because somebody is always sleeping. And even if you live in your own home, your father or mother who's ever working, at times they're going to be sleeping when you're home. So this quiet thing is only present in those mill towns. At any one time, somebody is always sleeping, and you best be quiet.
Another detail that takes us back to that time. David, were there any surprises for you as a historian looking at that period of time through that lens?
The main surprise I had was that they were doing piecework with shoes at home. Little kids. I didn't expect that in the 1960s. So yeah, that was my big surprise.
And what about you, Mamie? What did?
Oh, I just want to comment on what David said. I had in my neighborhood there was a family that I was very friendly with, and the mom worked in the shoe shop, and she did bring home the you know, the piecework to do over the weekend and at night and whatnot. Unfortunately, we never, you know, we were never allowed to do that, but it was always present there. And even into the mid-60s, early 70s.
It's interesting because it really is. Well, last year was 50 years. So mm-hmm. 50 years since the time in which this book was written about. What a difference a half century makes. You know, we may not realize it as we're living it, but then when we go back and look, we realize that the world was entirely different and life in Maine was entirely different.
And that's driving down here. That's what hit me was like, it really is 50 years. You know, it doesn't seem that long. And I think it's because she can cut across so many years so easily in telling her story and bringing it all together. It's like, wow, it is 50 years. How old would her father be today, you know, if he were alive? What would her life have been like?
So what I want to do before we go to break is read the very last line of the book and ask you all to comment on that. She's talking about the mill. She's going back to town. And she says, "Thank you, I tell the dying beast, I forgive you." What did you make of that line, Peter Kalman?
About 1,000 things. I mean, I think what I made of it is that the beast, you know, in a way gave her life, but that doesn't mean she didn't resent it. and it shows up many ways in the book with the alcoholism, you know, in her family, but in those communities, and just the depression that takes place when they start closing.
And what about you, David?
Well, I wasn't surprised by the beast because she had made that reference right from the beginning of the book that the mill is a monster. But the sense, very young in her life, that it's already dying. I mean, it's the mill is still very much there today, 50 years later, with a lot fewer workers, and that's a big difference. But then I guess I was a little caught by surprise about forgiveness, that she felt a need to forgive the mill. I didn't quite see that coming.
And Mamie?
And I saw it as the mill taking her father from her. You know, how hard they all worked in the mill, and I don't think it was that unusual for, you know, in that era for people to die early like that, that their jobs, you know, just really took them. And that's how I interpreted it.
And that's what her sister Anne thought from the beginning. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Silly's in Portland's East End. Open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends with vegan and gluten-free options, sillys.com.
Hi, this is Robin Rylette, your new host for Morning Classical Music. One of the great benefits of listening to MPBN is that our programming comes to you commercial-free, and that means that I have more time to share your favorite pieces of classical music and help you to discover new ones. In the same way, Super Thursday, MPBN's one-day pledge drive, is a very efficient way to raise the funds necessary to continue bringing you this beautiful music. And in fact, it means for you more music, more often. So let's keep this Maine magic going. Make your pledge this Super Thursday, April 3rd, during our spring membership campaign. Please call or pledge online for more wonderful music in the days, weeks, and months ahead.
Are you looking for something to do, or would you like to let folks know about something your organization is sponsoring? Well, that's why MPBN has the community calendar online at mpbn.net. It's easy to enter information about the events, just fill in the form, and it's also easy to find things. You can search by type of event, date, or location, or a combination. There are now about 1,000 events listed. MPBN's community calendar, bringing the people of Maine together with concerts, exhibits, workshops, lectures, and baked bean suppers, and quite a bit more. It's all at mpbn.net.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the second installment of the Maine Calling Book Club. The book we're discussing is a memoir about life in a small mill town in Maine, Mexico, Maine, in 1963. It's Monica Wood's When We Were the Kennedys. In the studio with me, David Richards, director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library in Skowhegan, Mamie Ney, head librarian at the Auburn Public Library, and Peter Kelman, who is a labor union historian. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Pete Kelman, in the book, there's some history of labor unions and of the town of Mexico, Maine, yeah, woven into this. We learn about, now I'm forgetting his first name, Chisholm, who founded the mills. And
Hugh Chisholm.
And you think there's a little bit to add to the story.
Well, right in the second paragraph, Monica says, "We'd been named by a band of settlers as a shout-out to the Mexican revolutionaries, a puzzling gesture." And actually, to me, it wasn't puzzling at all, because if you know the history of that time, and I think it's very well told in a book called Liberty Men and the Great Proprietors, there was a war in central Maine between very wealthy people who claimed the land, and they were trying to take it from the people who settled it. And a lot of the towns in Maine are actually named after that struggle between the Liberty Men and the Great Proprietors, like Liberty, Unity, Jefferson. And so it would be very apropos for people in that place to want to name their town after a fight for freedom. And I think in terms of the whole book, there's a lot of theme in that. I mean, the whole struggle between the mill workers and the owners is represented in actually the name of the town. And I realize that if you go to the town website, it gives you a little description about, you know, how they got their name. But it wasn't quirky at all. I think people really felt that, and they felt the identity with the Mexican revolutionaries, which was, you know, they're talking about 1815. They become a town in 1818. So that was very real to people in central Maine, that struggle.
And David, another historical fact or a historical reference in the book is to Margaret Chase Smith, but only briefly.
Yeah, well, I sort of come at it from the other angle, Margaret Chase Smith and her connections to Rumford. She served with Ed Muskie, who was from Rumford, and they both served in the Senate together. Interestingly, before I came down this morning, we had a school group in and we were showing them the video. And I was reminded in 1960 when she was running for Senate, the Democrats found a woman from Rumford to run against her, Lucia Cormier. And interestingly, in that video as well, there was a clip from the Kennedy funeral. Mm. So it was a little reminder of what I was going to be coming down to talk about.
Mm. We're going to go to the phones now. Is it Hilda in Harpswell?
Hildy.
Hildy, go ahead.
Okay. I just thought it was really neat to hear her read her book at a book signing in Bath a year ago, and to have a book about Maine by a Maine person and have it actually speak well for or speak about other communities that had factories where they sort of had all-time work that was taken home. I'm thinking specifically of in Brunswick where they had a health techs group and people would take piecework home to work on things. But anyway, how it has affected all of Maine when factories leave or when factories inundate your lives. And then one other aside is I was with my family in northern Maine where people were working in, I think, the paper mills. And we were asked to spend the night, and there were four bedrooms, but there were about 11 or 12 people, and I couldn't figure it out. But they hotbedded. The people would, if you were at work, you got out of your bed and somebody else got in it. So it was I realized how much people were doing other than farming, other than blueberrying, other than catching fish. They actually were working in the factories, and a lot of them working very, very hard and very, very lives that just were very, well, very overworked, underpaid.
Well, Hildy, thanks so much for your call. Going to Mitch in Durham. Hi, Mitch. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for the panel and for the book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. I grew up in Jay and had grandparents and parents that worked in the mills and the shoe shops. Just to follow up on Peter, I love the work that Peter's done with the unions, the history of all of that. I'm curious, and I'm just wondering if he might be able to follow up on it or at least look at. I know when he speaks of the Italians in Jay, I know a lot of them also came to work in the granite quarries in North Jay. I always grew up hearing that as well. And they didn't just come to work at the Otis IP, but also the granite quarries. And I don't know who came first or if there was an overlap, but just thought I would add that as well. And the other thing I want to say is my grandfather was sick in the late 70s, they were letting her use, in the late 70s, early 80s, bring home hand sewing from Bath, even then. And I can't wait to read the book because it sounds like there's a lot of great stuff in there.
There is. Peter, do you want to respond?
I believe the quarry workers came first. I was working for the on the rapid response team, actually, for the state when the Otis Mill was closed. And one of the questions I asked people, was, how many of you are Italians? And a couple would raise their hands, and I said, well, how did your people get here? And they all basically said those people were descendants from the people who built the mill itself. And that was one of the saddest series of meetings I've ever been in. And I told people that this mill is really a death in the family. You're all, for 100 years, your families have been interrelated through this work. And now they're closing this mill. And part of the contract when the mill was sold is that it would never be run as a paper mill again. And the equipment could not be sold in the United States, even though the union had found buyers for the mill.
Why?
They didn't want the internal competition. And this has happened a number of times in Maine. In fact, one time I was talking to Governor Baldacci, and he said the biggest problem he had in Old Town was the same thing, that they had buyers for the Old Town mill, but the company did not want the competition. And so it has never been reopened as a paper mill.
Mm.
And that's there are other places in the state that that's true. That's basically true in Baileyville where they're paper mill. Pulp mill still operates, and it's owned by the Chinese. Paper mill was destroyed, essentially.
Mitch, thanks so much for your call. Going to Dolores in Cape Porpoise. Hi, Dolores. Go ahead.
Well, I haven't read the book yet, but I relate in many ways to what happens in the book because my husband's tank was the Thresher, and we were living in South Berwick at the time, which was at one time a mill town, but it isn't a mill town anymore, but it is a small town. And when Monica talks about she forgives the mill, my son, who was 3 years old when his father passed, wrote a song in his 50s, and he says in the song, "And the tide came in and took you away from me." And it was another reminder of forgiveness. And I also received a letter from the Kennedys at the time. And then just a few months later, the president was assassinated. So I relate to this book on many levels, and I can't wait to read it.
Well, Dolores, thanks for your call, and I'm so sorry for your loss. And Mamie, you were the librarian in South Berwick. I'm sure you've heard about the mills there.
Yes, definitely. You know, one of them has been turned into housing, and you know, there is a very strong history there because they were able to come up the river, and you know, the shipping and going into the mills and whatnot. There's a very strong history there.
David.
Well, that call is a perfect example of why I love doing book discussion groups, the different angles and perspectives that you get. She's referring to the sinking of the sub, the Thresher. I think it was also in 63, coming out of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. I grew up in Portsmouth, and I actually went to school with kids who lost their fathers on the Thresher.
Mm.
So, you know, we all have heartache in our life. And, you know, when you do these book discussions, you just hear these very interesting angles on how people connect to books.
Go ahead, Mamie.
And I think one other thought that I had about the book is that this is going to be a very valuable book for a long time. I look at, you know, a lot of there's been a lot of fiction in the last several years that's come out about the mills down in Lowell. And, you know, even in Maine, I think of Anita Shreve's book and whatnot. This is going to be a valuable book for a long time because it addresses so many of those historical issues in such a personal way. It brings it home.
In an authentic way, too, not fictionalized. And we've talked amongst ourselves about Ernie's Ark, which didn't appeal to me as much because it seems too contrived.
That's another of Monica's books. Yeah, Monica Wood's books. Yeah.
And this is so authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Dolores, thanks so much for calling. We have an email from Matt. He writes, "It is interesting that all the mills workers live in Rumford or Mexico and don't commute from other nearby towns. Would Mr. Kelman care to comment about why employers are less likely to hire all their workers from near the workplace now than they were in 1963.
Sure. It comes about because it's one way to keep unions out, that when people live in communities with people that they don't work with, you lose the sense of solidarity, family solidarity. And so beginning in the 1950s, some companies started drawing like a 50-mile circle around their new facilities, and they hired people from each county around then because they what their sociologist and anthropologist told them was that if people live in the same community and work in the same place, there is a much greater sense of community. And in fact, that speaks for the Jay strike and the Rumford strike and the support they get and their ability to go out because they feel everybody's supporting them and they have that in common. And one of the things that they've broken with this way of hiring is that sense of community solidarity with the place you work and the people you work with.
Interesting. Going to Suzanne in Nobleboro. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I grew up in Chisholm, Maine, the town named after Hugh Chisholm. This was in the 40s. My dad was mill engineer. My mother was mill nurse. A little friend of mine and I would carry the lunch boxes down to the mill. If there was a freight train in the way, we'd climb under the freight cars and take the lunch boxes down. It was a poor town. We were Franco-Americans. My dad and mother were both institutions in the town. My dad was Louis Fournier. My mother was Yvette Fournier. And she passed away at the age of 100 a few years ago. But it was a wonderful little town to grow up in the mill, despite the fact that my dad had one heart attack after another working there. It kept the roof over our heads and food on our tables, even during the Depression. What is interesting is that my daughter-in-law, who's from Montana, is now environmental engineer at the J Mill.
Hmm. And so, Suzanne, you can really relate to Monica Wood's story then.
I love that book. I went to parochial school as she did, and so many of the stories, even though our family had a little house, friends of mine, we used to cross the dam to get to their house. They had no bathroom, no indoor running water. You know, there was a lot of poverty. The mill, luckily, kept people employed. It's a lot different today with so many of these factory jobs gone. But I just love Monica's book. I related so much to it.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that we haven't addressed is the influence of being Catholic on the family and in the town and in this book, too. I was very taken with what happened when she went back to school, how the nuns reacted and how she reacted. And, you know, the Catholic, she says the Catholic tradition of my childhood, which I recall with affection, some awe, and a measure of yearning, did not allow for randomness. Every word and deed, every sorrow and triumph, every birth and death belonged to a divine plan. And that's such an influence in this book, in how people can relate to it in their own stories. I'm, you know, parochial school graduate, and I think of my time there very fondly. You talk to other people, and they're like, oh, you know, you hear the horror stories, but I had a wonderful experience there.
Right, and when the nun tells her that she doesn't know why God took her father, mm-hmm. and that confuses Monica so much.
Right.
It's just something.
Because they're supposed to have the answers because it's part of that divine plan.
That's right. Suzanne, thank you so much for calling in. We are going to take another break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Main Calling possible, as does VIP Eyes. Located in the Pine Tree Shopping Center off Brighton Avenue in Portland, VIPEyesPortland.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Bryan Cranston. He plays LBJ in the new Broadway show, All the Way.
Now you call yourself the leader of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and show me some damn leadership!
That man scares me.
Not nearly as much as Walt. We'll talk with Cranston about acting and about his most famous character, Walter White, from Breaking Bad. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for Speaking in Maine. We'll head to the Muskie School at USM in Portland for Conversations with the Candidates, a series of one-on-one conversations with candidates from Maine's 2014 gubernatorial race. The candidate we'll speak with today is Elliot Cutler. Also a scheduling note, tomorrow's program will be candidate Mike Michoud. Governor Paul LePage has not yet scheduled a conversation with the Muskie School Conversations with the Candidates. But today, do join us for candidate Elliot Cutler. That's following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Maine Calling Book Club. We're discussing When We Were the Kennedys by Monica Wood. In the studio with me, Peter Kelman, a labor union historian, David Richards, director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library in Skowhegan, and Mamie Nye, head librarian at the Auburn Public Library. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Going to Larry in Falmouth. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am a friend and former colleague of Monica's before she went to writing full-time. And I want to just express how much I admire her for her achievement in writing. One day she got together with a group of us and was talking about writing and said that in the world there are only two
types of people, writers and people who would like to be writers, mm-hmm. and the difference was that the writers actually write. And as someone that dabbles, I understand that completely. I was glad that someone mentioned Ernie's arc as well, because it's a wonderful portrayal of a mill town. I grew up in Westbrook back when it was Mother Warren, and had a massive impact on the community, especially the young people of the community. And Ernie's arc I taught for many years, and it gave my students a great insight into the way that the mill town used to be and what happened when the strikes came. So anyway, I just wanted to, again, express my great my great admiration for Monica, and I'll get off the phone and let you guys continue. Thank you.
Larry, thanks so much for calling. David, that is a bit of an issue with this book, isn't it, that people just want to say how much they love it?
Yes. Well, it's interesting, the comments that he made. It reminds me of two points. One, at the end of the book, she comments on the first draft struck her as coming off as being written like an instructional manual.
Right,
and I
right.
can't for the life of me see where there's an instructional manual in this very elegant, eloquent memoir. But the other point that he raises is that I truly believe, and this is another perspective I have, I teach writing. Everyone has a story. Everyone has a memoir to tell. And the trick for teachers is to try to get that memoir out of people.
And we've been discussing having a book about a show about writing memoirs on Maine Calling.
Oh,
so you've
okay.
just boosted that it's a, idea a little bit.
It's a great idea.
Okay. Going to Margaret and Brewer. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very, very much for the idea of a book club. I think it's wonderful. And thank you for taking my call. And I grew up in Buckfield, Maine, which is down what used to be the Maine Central Railroad connection between Rumford and either Auburn or Lewiston. And one time before the train stopped running, I did take the train to Mexico all by myself to visit a friend. But my other connection with the town of Mexico was I used to play on the Buckfield High School softball team, and we used to travel to Mexico to play the Mexico High School softball team. I think they have since joined Rumford. I don't think there is any Mexico High School anymore. I think Mexico and Rumford have a joint school. But we used to travel up there and play softball, and my big impression that lasts with me was the very bad smell from the polluted Androscoggin River. And I lived down in Buckfield, and we used to go visit an aunt who lived in Green, and we had to cross the Androscoggin River between Turner and Green, and the river was really terribly polluted at that time. And just recently, we've been hearing a lot about Muskie, because I think it's his 100th anniversary or something.
100th birthday tomorrow.
Right, and I think, wasn't he someone who was very prominent in getting a lot of the rivers in Maine cleaned up?
That's right, all over the nation, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. You know, there are a lot of coincidences this week, things coming together that we're talking about.
Yes, well, I was interested in the other comments of all the people that you've had on today, and I think this book club idea is wonderful, and thank you so much. But also, I'm impressed by the changes. The people have spoken about the changes. Of course, one of the big changes is the Maine Central Railroad no longer runs between Mexico and Rumford and those cities down river. And also that the Androscoggin River is not horribly polluted anymore. So there there have been a lot of changes. But thank you for giving us this chance to listen to other people's comments and to share, and I just loved the book. I was very, very fortunate to be able to meet Monica and hear her talk at a Bangor book fair.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much, and it is our pleasure. We're having a wonderful time with this book club idea. And, you know, Monica, as you know, since you read the book, talks about watching the tourists drive through Mexico and hold their noses and hold things up to their noses because as children, they thought it was amusing that people thought that the town smelled. Thank you so much for calling, Margaret.
My father used to work for Scott Paper Company, and the saying was it's the smell of money.
Yep, smell of money. Thank you, Margaret. going to, I'm going to read an email. This is from Donna. She writes, when we were the Kennedys resonated strongly with me. I feel my childhood in the Augusta area paralleled hers in Mexico. I, too, have a disabled sister, as well as three others. My parents loved Kennedy for what he did for the developmentally delayed. My grandfather was a mill worker down east, and my father was a local butcher. Growing up in a large family, we were taught the main value to work hard and get your education. My parents wanted us to have an easier life than they or previous generations had. I loved this book and gave several for Christmas. And, I mean, a lot in that email, but we haven't really talked about her sister, who is still going strong. Monica has a video of her sister on her website, mentally disabled. But that is an interesting parallel I hadn't thought of, that the very that President Kennedy, whose assassination is part of this book, was also such a big advocate for the developmentally disabled. Go ahead, Peter.
I want to talk about the smell of money for a minute, because it's a term that always disturbs me, and that and it speaks to a lot of what this book is about, is that it's the trade-off that people have to make, that in order to earn a decent living, you have to give up your health. I mean, Rumford, Maine is one of the pockets of cancer in this state. And anybody who lives downwind of a paper mill knows it's not just the smell, it's the disease. And those rivers, not to take anything away from Ed Muskie or anybody else who worked on those laws, those rivers are cleaner than they used to be, but they're not clean. The rivers have not been really cleaned up, and there's still a lot of dangerous toxins in those rivers, and they get stirred up. And I think they're still probably putting oxygen in down in Lewiston because of the oxygen that's taken out from the mills. The other thing is that just a fact about what's happened with these towns and the workers is that in some of the mills, like the Scott Mill you were talking about in Winslow, at one time employed more people than now all of the paper mills in the state employ together. There were a couple thousand people in that mill, and I think 3,000 or 4,000 at one time, and that was true of other mills. Today, I don't think there's more than 4,000 paper workers in the state.
Mm. Nancy in Brunswick. Go ahead. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was very impressed with Monica meeting the obstacles that she faced. Of course, the death of her father, and then the sort of mystery of the alcoholic Uncle Bob. And what impressed me is that she and the rest of her family exhibit wonderful mental and emotional health in being able to cope with these adversities. And I thought perhaps her mother was the foundation of a lot of this good attitude and faith. And also, I did hear Monica speak in the Topsom Public Library and was very impressed by her and her husband. And they sang a lovely duet there. And I understand that music was a very big theme in the book. And I'd like to hear what others have to say about these ideas. Thank you.
Thanks, Nancy.
I didn't know about her singing ability. We'll have to, next time I see her, I'll have to ask her to reprise her song.
To me, the hero of the book, the caller just referenced the mother, it was Anne. To me, it's St. Anne is the hero of the story that keeps the family together, mm-hmm. the older sister.
Well, and I think Monica was she's the writer. And what, you know, as a historian and person who writes nonfiction, I'm always in awe of fiction writers. And I think that fiction can often tell history better than nonfiction can, because it allows you to imagine what it would be like to live there, which is hard for a nonfiction writer to do. But in this case, this book it's so real. It's almost like fiction to me. It reads like fiction. I know it's true, and that's what's really great about it. I mean, that was one of the things that impressed me about this book, is that I'm reading it like it's like a person has the liberties of a fiction writer, yet it's all true. I mean, it's nonfiction, but the way it reads is just so great. I guess you can tell I think it's a great book.
And she's very upfront. She says, this is how I remember things. You know, there may be some discrepancies in the book that, you know, people have said something about, but she said, this is how I remember it. And that makes it very authentic.
Thank you for your call, Nancy. Going to, let's see, Nicole on Peaks Island. Hi, Nicole, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking this call. I just wanted to comment on what the person said prior to me.
it is a beautifully written book, and it is literary nonfiction. I mean, it's memoir, but it's literary nonfiction. It's beautiful description, really sharp dialogue. And what I wanted to just kind of pinpoint was the reflection of how Monica does Catholic education during that time, because there's been a lot of stereotypical references. I went to Catholic school for 16 years, and I had nuns like that, and I knew priests like that. And, you know, the nuns were, they had their quirks, and I'll reference Monica's nuns, who were French nuns, I believe. You know, they were stern, and they were great educators. And the priest, her uncle, was a thoroughly decent guy who was flawed. And I appreciate that depiction, because I think the Catholic Church, I'm not an observant Catholic anymore, but, you know, I think it's taken it in the neck a lot because of past discrepancies in various people. So I was glad to see this particular depiction of the Catholic world of that time. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Nicole, for your call. Going to Bernie, calling from Brookline, New Hampshire.
Yes, that's right. Hi. I'm listening on the Internet, and I wanted to say that I grew up in Mexico. I was just a couple of years older than Monica. In fact, I'm looking at the cover of the book now, and I see my English teacher, Ann Wood, portrayed there. And the thing that I wanted to say is that I was not Catholic. My father did not work in the mill, but it still depicts my life. In fact, to the extent that I bought copies of this book to give to my daughter so they might understand my beginnings a little bit better.
And I think you're not alone, Bernie. We were hearing a lot of people reading this book and then buying it for others. This is everybody in the room is nodding. Thanks so much for calling in. Going to Eddie in Belfast. Hi, Eddie. Go ahead.
Hi there. You keep talking about the reader identifying with the characters in this story. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York in 1963. I was a 13-year-old boy. I probably couldn't have been any further away from the character in this story. And by page two, I had become a 9-year-old girl living in Mexico, Maine. And that's just a writer at the top of her game, to be able to get the reader involved that quickly and that intensely. It's wonderful, and I love the book.
Thanks so much for calling. I think there are others who agree, and that's what you're hearing, David, over and over in your book groups, right?
Yeah, and, you know, he grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and the setting is different, but the issues, religion, family, work, you know, no matter where you live, the same issues.
Thanks for your call. And I think we have time for one more. So Susan at Bodenham. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I grew up in Lisbon Falls, and so for us, which was also a mill town, but in growing up, Lewiston was a very successful mill town, and I think Monica mentioned something in her book about being poor but not knowing they were poor. Does she reference something like that?
Yeah, she says that they were rich.
Right, but so I'm wondering what the possibilities are of communities, the former mill towns, ever getting a workforce back, ever having some sort of industry, given the current attitude towards work and pay and what our expectations are for what we consider a successful life. I'm just wondering, with jobs going over to other countries, whether we'll ever see a sort of a turnaround and have it come back to our country, and what is the panel's opinion on that?
Boy, you've asked one of the big questions.
Well, I think they could come back. I mean, the reason we lose the jobs are political and economic reasons. I was taken by Angela Merkel's response a couple of years ago to the question as to why did Germany do so well during this great worldwide recession recently. And her answer was, it's because we still make things here. They have laws that protect their ability to make things. We don't. We ship our jobs out. And I think that unless this fast-track stuff and the NAFTA stuff is reversed, we'll be a nation of service people, basically. We won't be making anything.
Interesting question, Susan, and thank you, Pete. And since we have just a few seconds, I'm going to read an email from Ruth. The oldest daughter in the family, Anne, truly impressed me with her selflessness, compassion, and ability to care for her younger sister siblings and support her mother. I wonder if today's younger generation would or could respond to a situation like this in the same way Anne did. So reflecting your thought, David, that Anne was the real hero in this book. We are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Mamie Nye, head librarian at the Auburn Public Library. David Richards is director of the Margaret Chase Smith Library in Skowhegan. And Peter Kelman, a labor union historian. Our next installment of our book club, drum roll please, will be The Poacher's Son by Paul Dworin. It is the first in a series of books by Dworin about Maine game warden Mike Bowditch. The Poacher's Son examines the ties between fathers and sons, the changing Maine landscape, and the search for a killer in the North Woods of Maine. You can find more information about the book on the MPBN website and on the Maine Calling Facebook page. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
A lot of